22. To sail the cylindrical sea. When they reached the foot of the stairway, they had another shock. At first it appeared that something had gone through the camp, overturning equipment, even collecting smaller objects and carrying them away. But after a brief examination, their alarm was replaced by a rather shame-faced annoyance. The culprit was only the wind. Though they had tied down all loose objects before they left, some ropes must have parted during exceptionally strong gusts. It was several days before they were able to retrieve all their scattered property. Otherwise, there seemed no major changes. Even the silence of Rama had returned, now that the ephemeral storms of spring were over. And out there at the edge of the plain was a calm sea, waiting for the first ship in a million years.
Shouldn't one christen a new boat with a bottle of champagne?
Even if we had some on board, I wouldn't allow such a criminal waste. Anyway, it's too late. We've already launched the thing. At least it does float. You've won your bet, Jimmy. I'll settle when we get back to Earth.
It's got to have a name. Any ideas?
The subject of these unflattering comments was now bobbing beside the steps leading down into the cylindrical sea. It was a small raft, constructed from 6 empty storage drums, held together by a light metal framework. Building it, assembling it at Camp Alpha, and hauling it on demountable wheels across more than 10 kilometers of plain had absorbed the crew's entire energies for several days. It was a gamble that had better pay off. The prize was worth the risk. The enigmatic towers of New York, gleaming there in the shadowless light 5 kilometers away, had taunted them ever since they had entered Rama. No one doubted that the city, or whatever it might be, was the real heart of this world. If they did nothing else, they must reach New York.
We still don't have a name. Skipper, what about it?
Norton laughed, then became suddenly serious.
I've got one for you. Call it Resolution.
Why?
That was one of Cook's ships. It's a good name. May she live up to it.
There was a thoughtful silence. Then Sergeant Barnes, who had been principally responsible for the design, asked for 3 volunteers. Everyone present held up a hand.
Sorry, we have only 4 life jackets. Boris, Jimmy, Peter. You've all done some sailing. Let's try her out.
No one thought it in the least peculiar that an executive sergeant was now taking charge of the proceedings. Ruby Barnes had the only master's certificate aboard, so that settled the matter. She had navigated racing trimarans across the Pacific, and it did not seem likely that a few kilometers of dead calm water would present much of a challenge to her skills. Ever since she had set eyes upon the sea, she had been determined to make this voyage. In all the thousands of years that man had had dealings with the waters of his own world, no sailor had ever faced anything remotely like this. In the last few days, a silly little jingle had been running through her mind, and she could not get rid of it. To sail the cylindrical sea. Well, that was precisely what she was going to do. Her passengers took their places on the improvised bucket seats, and Ruby opened the throttle. The 20-kilowatt motor started to whir, the chain drives of the reduction gear blurred, and Resolution surged away to the cheers of the spectators. Ruby had hoped to get 15 kph with this load, but would settle for anything over 10. A half-kilometer course had been measured along the cliff, and she made the round trip in 5.5 minutes. Allowing for turning time, this worked out at 12 kph, and she was quite happy with that. With no power, but with three energetic paddlers helping her own more skillful blade, Ruby was able to get a quarter of this speed. So even if the motor broke down, they could get back to shore in a couple of hours. The heavy-duty power cells could provide enough energy to circumnavigate the world, but she was carrying two spares, to be on the safe side. And now that the fog had completely burned away, even such a cautious mariner as Ruby was prepared to put to sea without a compass. She saluted smartly as she stepped ashore.
Maiden voyage of resolution successfully completed, sir. Now awaiting your instructions.
Very good, Admiral. When will you be ready to sail?
As soon as stores can be loaded aboard and the harbormaster gives us clearance.
Then we leave at dawn.
Aye, aye, sir.
5 kilometers of water does not seem much on a map. It is very different when one is in the middle of it. They had been cruising for only 10 minutes, and the 50-meter cliff facing the northern continent already seemed a surprising distance away. Yet, mysteriously, New York appeared hardly much closer than before. Most of the time they paid little attention to the land. They were still too engrossed in the wonder of the sea. They no longer made the nervous jokes that had punctuated the start of the voyage. This new experience was too overwhelming.
Every time, Norton said to himself, I feel that I've grown accustomed to Rama. It produces some new wonder.
As Resolution hummed steadily forward, it seemed again and again that they were caught in the trough of a gigantic wave, a wave that curved up on either side until it became vertical, then overhung until the two flanks met in a liquid arch 16 kilometers above their heads. Despite everything that reason and logic told them, none of the voyagers could for long throw off the impression that at any minute those millions of tons of water would come crashing down from the sky. Yet, despite this, their main feeling was one of exhilaration. There was a sense of danger, without any real danger. Unless, of course, the sea itself produced more surprises. That was a distinct possibility, for, as Mercer had guessed, the water was now alive. Every spoonful contained thousands of spherical, single-celled microorganisms, similar to the earliest forms of plankton that had existed in the oceans of Earth. Yet, they showed puzzling differences. They lacked a nucleus, as well as many of the other minimum requirements of even the most primitive terrestrial life forms. And although Laura Ernst, now doubling as research scientist and ship's doctor, had proved that they definitely generated oxygen, there were far too few of them to account for the augmentation of Rama's atmosphere. They should have existed in billions, not mere thousands. Then she discovered that their numbers were dwindling rapidly and must have been far higher during the first hours of the Raman dawn. It was as if there had been a brief explosion of life, recapitulating, on a trillion-fold swifter timescale, the early history of Earth. Now, perhaps, it had exhausted itself. The drifting microorganisms were disintegrating, releasing their stores of chemicals back into the sea.
If you have to swim for it, Dr. Ernst had warned the mariners, keep your mouths closed. A few drops won't matter if you spit them out right away. But all those weird organometallic salts add up to a fairly poisonous package, and I'd hate to have to work out an antidote.
This danger, fortunately, seemed unlikely. Resolution could stay afloat if any two of her buoyancy tanks were punctured. When told of this, Calvert had muttered darkly, "Remember the Titanic?" And even if she sank, the crude but efficient life jackets would keep their heads above water. Although Dr. Ernst had been reluctant to give a firm ruling on this, She did not think that a few hours' immersion in the sea would be fatal, but she did not recommend it. After 20 minutes of steady progress, New York was no longer a distant island. It was becoming a real place, and details they had seen only through telescopes and photo enlargements were now revealing themselves as massive, solid structures. It was now strikingly apparent that the city, like so much of Rama, was triplicated. It consisted of 3 identical circular complexes or superstructures rising from a long, oval foundation. Photographs taken from the hub had also indicated that each complex was itself divided into 3 equal components, like a pie sliced into 120-degree portions. This would greatly simplify the task of exploration. Presumably, they had to examine only 1/9 of New York to see the whole of it. Even this would be a formidable undertaking. It would mean investigating at least a square kilometer of buildings and machinery, some of which towered hundreds of meters into the air. The Ramans, it seemed, had brought the art of triple redundancy to a high degree of perfection. This was demonstrated in the airlock system, the stairways at the hub, the artificial suns. And where it really mattered, they had even taken the next step. New York appeared to be an example of triple-triple redundancy. Ruby was steering Resolution toward the central complex, where a flight of steps led up from the water to the top of the wall, or levee, that surrounded the island. There was even a conveniently placed mooring post to which boats could be tied. When she saw this, Ruby became quite excited. Now, she would never be content until she found one of the craft in which the Ramans sailed their extraordinary sea. Norton was the first to step ashore. He looked back at his 3 companions and said, "Wait here on the boat until I get to the top of the wall. When I wave, Peter and Boris will join me. You stay at the helm, Ruby, so that we can cast off at a moment's notice. If anything happens to me, report to Carl and follow his instructions. Use your best judgment, but no heroics. Understood?"
"Yes, Skipper. Good luck."
Commander Norton did not really believe in luck. He never got into a situation until he had analyzed all the factors involved and had secured his line of retreat. But once again, Rama was forcing him to break some of his cherished rules. Almost every factor here was unknown as the Pacific and the Great Barrier Reef had been to his hero 3.5 centuries ago. Yes, he could do with all the luck that happened to be lying around. The stairway was a virtual duplicate of the one they had descended on the other side of the sea, where, doubtless, his friends were looking straight across at him through their telescopes. And straight was now the correct word. In this one direction, parallel to the axis of Rama, the sea was indeed completely flat. It might well be the only body of water in the universe of which this was true. For on all other worlds, every sea and lake must follow the surface of a sphere, with equal curvature in all directions.
"Nearly at the top," he reported, speaking for the record and for his intently listening second-in-command, 5 kilometers away. "Still completely quiet. Radiation normal. I'm holding the meter above my head, just in case this wall is acting as a shield for anything. And if there are any hostiles on the other side, they'll shoot that first."
He was joking, of course. And yet, why take any chances, when it was just as easy to avoid them? When he took the last step, he found that the flat-topped embankment was about 10 meters thick. On the inner side, an alternating series of ramps and stairways led down to the main level of the city, 20 meters below. In effect, he was standing on a high wall, which completely surrounded New York, and so was able to get a grandstand view of it. It was a view almost stunning in its complexity, and his first act was to make a slow panoramic scan with his camera. Then he waved to his companions and radioed back across the sea. No sign of any activity. Everything quiet. Come on up. We'll start exploring. 23. N.Y. Rama. It was not a city. It was a machine. Norton had come to that conclusion in 10 minutes and saw no reason to change it after they had made a complete traverse of the island. A city, whatever the nature of its occupants, surely had to provide some form of accommodation. There was nothing here of that nature, unless it was underground. And if that was the case, where were the entrances, the stairways, the elevators? He had not found anything that even qualified as a simple door. The closest analogy to this place that he had ever seen on Earth was a giant chemical processing plant. However, there were no stockpiles of raw materials or any indications of a transport system to move them around. Nor could he imagine where the finished product would emerge, still less what that product could possibly be. It was all very baffling, and more than a little frustrating. "Anybody care to make a guess?" he said at last, to all who might be listening. "If this is a factory, what does it make, and where does it get its raw materials?"
I've a suggestion, Skipper," said Mercer, over on the far shore. "Suppose it uses the sea. According to Doc, that contains just about anything you can think of."
It was a plausible answer, and Norton had already considered it. There could well be buried pipes leading to the sea. In fact, there must be, for any conceivable chemical plant would require large quantities of water. But he had a suspicion of plausible answers. They were so often wrong.
"That's a good idea, Kyle. But what does New York do with its seawater?"
For a long time, nobody answered from ship, hub, or northern plain. Then an unexpected voice spoke.
"That's easy, Skipper, but you're all going to laugh at me."
"No, we are not, Ravi. Go ahead."
Ravi McAndrews, chief steward and simp master, was the last person on the Endeavor who would normally get involved in a technical discussion. His IQ was modest, and his scientific knowledge was minimal, but he was no fool, and he had a natural shrewdness that everyone respected.
"Well, it's a factory, all right, Skipper, and maybe the sea provides the raw material. After all, that's how it all happened on Earth, though in a different way. I believe New York is a factory for making
ramens." Somebody, somewhere, snickered, but became quickly silent and did not identify himself.
"You know, Ravi," said his commander at last, "that theory is crazy enough to be true, and I'm not sure if I want to see it tested, at least until I get back to the mainland."
This celestial New York was just about as wide as the island of Manhattan, but its geometry was totally different. There were few straight thoroughfares. It was a maze of short, concentric arcs, with radial spokes linking them. Luckily, it was impossible to lose one's bearings inside Rama. A single glance at the sky was enough to establish the north-south axis of the world. They paused at almost every intersection to make a panoramic scan. When all these hundreds of pictures were sorted out, it would be a tedious but fairly straightforward job to construct an accurate scale model of the city. Norton suspected that the resulting jigsaw puzzle would keep scientists busy for generations. It was even harder to get used to the silence here than it had been out on the plain of Rama. A city machine should make some sound, yet there was not even the faintest of electric hums, or the slightest whisper of mechanical motion. Several times Norton put his ear to the ground, or to the side of a building, and listened intently. He could hear nothing except the pounding of his own blood. The machines were sleeping. They were not even ticking over. Would they ever wake again, and for what purpose? Everything was in perfect condition, as usual. It was easy to believe that the closing of a single circuit in some patient, hidden computer would bring all this maze back to life. When at last they had reached the far side of the city, they climbed to the top of the surrounding levee and looked across the southern branch of the sea. For a long time, Norton stared at the 500-meter cliff that barred them from almost half of Rama, and, judging from their telescopic surveys, the most complex and varied half. From this angle, it appeared an ominous, forbidding black, and it was easy to think of it as a prison wall surrounding a whole continent. Nowhere along its entire circle were there stairways or any other means of access. He wondered how the Ramans reached their southern land from New York. Probably there was a transport system running beneath the sea, but they must also have aircraft, because there were many open areas here in the city that could be used for landing. To discover a Raman vehicle would be a major accomplishment, especially if they could learn to operate it. Though, could any conceivable power source still be functioning after several hundred thousand years? There were numerous structures that had the functional look of hangars or garages, but they were all smooth and windowless, as if they had been sprayed with sealer. Sooner or later, Norton told himself grimly, we'll be forced to use explosives and laser beams. He was determined to put off this decision to the last possible moment. His reluctance to use brute force was based partly on pride, partly on fear. He did not wish to behave like a technological barbarian, smashing what he could not understand. After all, he was an uninvited visitor in this world, and should act accordingly. As for his fear, perhaps that was too strong a word. Apprehension might be better. The Ramans seemed to have planned for everything. He was not anxious to discover the precautions they had taken to guard their property. When he sailed back to the mainland, it would be with empty hands. 24. Dragonfly. Lieutenant James Pack was the most junior officer on board Endeavor, and this was only his fourth mission into deep space. He was ambitious and due for promotion. He had also committed a serious breach of regulations. No wonder, therefore, that he took a long time to make up his mind. It would be a gamble. If he lost, he could be in deep trouble. He would not only be risking his career, he might even be risking his neck. But if he succeeded, he would be a hero. What finally convinced him was neither of these arguments. It was the certainty that if he did nothing at all, he would spend the rest of his life brooding over his lost opportunity. Nevertheless, he was still hesitant when he asked Commander Norton for a private meeting. What is it this time? Norton asked himself as he analyzed the uncertain expression on the young officer's face. He remembered his delicate interview with Boris Rodrigo. No, it wouldn't be anything like that. Pack was certainly not the religious type. The only interests he had ever shown outside his work were sport and sex, preferably combined. It could hardly be the former, and Norton hoped it was not the latter. He had encountered most of the problems that a commanding officer could encounter in this department, except the classical one of an unscheduled birth during a mission. Though this situation was the subject of innumerable jokes, it had never happened yet. But such gross incompetence was probably only a matter of time.
Well, Jimmy, what is it?
I have an idea, Commander. I know how to reach the southern continent, even the South Pole.
I'm listening. How do you propose to do it?
By flying there.
Jimmy, I've had at least 5 proposals to do that. More, if you count crazy suggestions from Earth. We've looked into the possibility of adapting our spacesuit propulsors, but air drag would make them hopelessly inefficient. They'd run out of fuel before they could go 10 kilometers.
I know that, but I have the answer.
Peck's attitude was a curious mixture of complete confidence and barely suppressed nervousness. Norton was quite baffled. What was the kid worried about? Surely he knew his commanding officer well enough to be certain that no reasonable proposal would be laughed out of court.
Well, go on. If it works, I'll see your promotion is retroactive.
That little half-promise, half-joke didn't go down as well as he had hoped. Jimmy gave a rather sickly smile, made several false starts, then decided on an oblique approach to the subject.
You know, Commander, that I was in the Lunar Olympics last year.
Of course. Sorry you didn't win.
It was bad equipment. I know what went wrong. I have friends on Mars who've been working on it in secret. We want to give everyone a surprise.
Mars? But I didn't know.
Not many people do. The sport's still new there. It's only been tried in the Zante Sports Dome, but the best aerodynamicists in the solar system are on Mars. If you can fly in that atmosphere, you can fly anywhere. Now, my idea was that if the Martians could build a good machine with all their know-how, it would really perform on the moon, where gravity is only half as strong.
That seems plausible, but how does it help us?
Norton was beginning to guess, but he wanted to give Jimmy plenty of rope.
Well, I formed a syndicate with some friends in Port Lowell. They've built a fully aerobatic flyer with some refinements that no one has ever seen before. In lunar gravity, under the Olympic Dome, it should create a sensation.
And win you the gold medal.
I hope so.
Let me see if I follow your train of thought correctly. A sky bike that could enter the Lunar Olympics at a sixth of a gravity would be even more sensational inside Rama, with no gravity at all. You could fly it right along the axis, from the North Pole to the South and back again.
Yes, easily. The one-way trip would take 3 hours non-stop. But, of course, you could rest whenever you wanted to, as long as you kept near the axis.
It's a brilliant idea, and I congratulate you. What a pity skybikes aren't part of regular space survey equipment.
Jimmy seemed to have some difficulty in finding words. He opened his mouth several times, but nothing happened.
All right, Jimmy. As a matter of morbid interest and purely off the record, how did you smuggle the thing aboard?
Recreational stores?
Well, you weren't lying. And what about the weight?
It's only 20 kilograms.
Only?
Still, it's not as bad as I thought. In fact, I'm astonished you can build a bike at that weight.
Some have been only 15, but they were too fragile and usually folded up when they made a turn. There's no danger of Dragonfly doing that. As I said, she's fully aerobatic.
Dragonfly. Nice name. So tell me just how you plan to use her. Then I can decide whether a promotion or a court-martial is in order, or both.
25. Maiden Flight. Dragonfly was certainly a good name. The long, tapering wings were almost invisible, except when the light struck them from certain angles and was refracted into rainbow hues. It was as if a soap bubble had been wrapped around a delicate tracery of aerofoil sections. The envelope enclosing the little flyer was an organic film, only a few molecules thick, yet strong enough to control and direct the movements of a 50-kilometer-per-hour airflow. The pilot, who was also the power plant and the guidance system, sat on a tiny seat at the center of gravity, in a semi-reclining position to reduce air resistance. Control was by a single stick, which could be moved backward and forward, right and left. The only instrument was a piece of weighted ribbon attached to the leading edge to show the direction of the relative wind. Once the flyer had been assembled at the hub, Jimmy Pack would allow no one to touch it. Clumsy handling could snap one of the single-fiber structural members, and those glittering wings were an almost irresistible attraction to prying fingers. It was hard to believe that there was really something there. As he watched Jimmy climb into the contraption, Norton began to have second thoughts. If one of those wire-sized struts snapped when Dragonfly was on the other side of the cylindrical sea, Jimmy would have no way of getting back, even if he was able to make a safe landing. They were also breaking one of the most sacrosanct rules of space exploration. A man was going alone into unknown territory, beyond all possibility of help. The only consolation was that he would be in full view and communication all the time. If he did meet with disaster, they would know exactly what had happened to him. Yet this opportunity was far too good to miss. If one believed in fate or destiny, it would be challenging the gods themselves to neglect the only chance they might ever have of reaching the far side of Rama and seeing at close quarters the mysteries of the South Pole. Jimmy knew what he was attempting, far better than anyone in the crew could tell him. This was precisely the sort of risk that had to be taken. If it failed, that was the luck of the game. You couldn't win them all. "Now listen to me carefully, Jimmy," said Laura Ernst. "It's very important not to overexert yourself. Remember, the oxygen level here at the Axis is still very low. If you feel breathless at any time, stop and hyperventilate for 30 seconds, but no longer." Jimmy nodded absentmindedly as he tested the controls. The whole rudder elevator assembly, which formed a single unit on an outrigger 5 meters behind the rudimentary cockpit, began to twist around. Then the flap-shaped ailerons, halfway along the wing, moved alternately up and down. "Do you want me to swing the prop?" asked Joe Calvert, unable to repress memories of 200-year-old war movies. "Ignition. Contact." Probably no one except Jimmy knew what he was talking about, but it helped to relieve the tension. Very slowly, Jimmy started to move the foot pedals. The flimsy, broad fan of the air screw, like the wing, a delicate skeleton covered with shimmering film, began to turn. By the time it had made a few revolutions, it had disappeared completely, and Dragonfly was on her way. She lifted straight upward, or outward, from the hub, moving slowly along the axis of Rama. When she had traveled 100 meters, Jimmy stopped pedaling. It was strange to see an obviously aerodynamic vehicle hanging motionless in mid-air. This must be the first time such a thing had ever happened, except possibly on a limited scale inside one of the larger space stations. "How does she handle?" Norton called.
Response, good. Stability, poor. But I know what the trouble is. No gravity. We'll be better off a kilometer lower down.
Now, wait a minute. Is that safe?
By losing altitude, Jimmy would be sacrificing his main advantage. As long as he stayed precisely on the axis, he and Dragonfly would be completely weightless. He could hover effortlessly, or even go to sleep if he wished. But as soon as he moved away from the central line around which Rama spun, the pseudo-weight of centrifugal force would reappear. And so, unless he could maintain himself at this altitude, he would continue to lose height, and at the same time, to gain weight. It would be an accelerating process, which could end in catastrophe. The gravity down on the plane of Rama was twice that in which Dragonfly had been designed to operate. Jimmy might be able to make a safe landing. He could certainly never take off again. But he had already considered all this, and he answered confidently enough. I can manage a tenth of a G without any trouble, and she'll handle more easily in denser air. In a slow, leisurely spiral, Dragonfly drifted across the sky, roughly following the line of Stairway Alpha down toward the plane. From some angles, the little skybike was almost invisible. Jimmy seemed to be sitting in mid-air, pedaling furiously. Sometimes he moved in spurts of up to 30 kilometers an hour. Then he would coast to a halt, getting the feel of the controls, before accelerating again. And he was always careful to keep a safe distance from the curving face of Rama. It was soon obvious that Dragonfly handled much better at lower altitudes. She no longer rolled around at any angle, but stabilized so that her wings were parallel to the plane 7 kilometers below. Jimmy completed several wide orbits, then started to climb upward again. He finally halted a few meters above his waiting colleagues and realized, a little belatedly, that he was not quite sure how to land his gossamer craft.
"Shall we throw you a rope?" Norton asked, half seriously.
"No, Skipper. I've got to work this out myself. I won't have anyone to help me at the other end."
He sat, thinking for a while, then started to ease Dragonfly toward the hub with short bursts of power. She quickly lost momentum between each, as air drag brought her to rest again. When he was only 5 meters away and the skybike was still barely moving, Jimmy abandoned ship. He let himself float toward the nearest safety line in the hub webwork, grasped it, then swung around in time to catch the approaching bike with his hands. The maneuver was so neatly executed that it drew a round of applause.
"For my next act," Joe Calvert began.
Jimmy was quick to disclaim any credit.
"That was messy," he said. "But now I know how to do it. I'll take a sticky bomb on a 20-meter line. Then I'll be able to pull myself in wherever I want to."
"Give me your wrist, Jimmy," ordered the doctor. "And blow into this bag. I'll want a blood sample, too. Did you have any difficulty in breathing?"
"Only at this altitude."
"Hey, what do you want the blood for?"
"Sugar level, so I can tell how much energy you've used. We've got to make sure you can carry enough fuel for the mission. By the way, what's the endurance record for skybiking?"
2 hours, 25 minutes, 3.6 seconds. On the moon, of course. A 2-kilometer circuit in the Olympic Dome."
"And you think you can keep it up for 6 hours?
"Easily, since I can stop for a rest at any time. Skybiking on the moon is at least twice as hard as it is here."
"Okay, Jimmy, back to the lab. I'll give you a go, no go, as soon as I've analyzed these samples. I don't want to raise false hopes, but I think you can make it."
A large smile of satisfaction spread across Jimmy's ivory-hued countenance. As he followed Surgeon Commander Ernst to the airlock, he called back to his companions.
Hands off, please. I don't want anyone putting his fist through the wings.
I'll see to that, Jimmy, promised the commander. Dragonfly is off limits to everybody, including myself.
26. The Voice of Rama. The real magnitude of his adventure did not hit Jimmy Pack until he reached the coast of the Cylindrical Sea. Until now, he had been over known territory. Barring a catastrophic structural failure, he could always land and walk back to base in a few hours. That option no longer existed. If he came down in the sea, he would probably drown, quite unpleasantly, in its poisonous waters. And even if he made a safe landing on the southern continent, it might be impossible to rescue him before Endeavor had to break away from Rama's sunward orbit. He was also acutely aware that the foreseeable disasters were the ones most unlikely to happen. The totally unknown region over which he was flying might produce any number of surprises. Suppose there were flying creatures here who objected to his intrusion. He would hate to engage in a dogfight with anything larger than a pigeon. A few well-placed pecks could destroy Dragonfly's aerodynamics. Yet, if there were no hazards, there would be no achievement, no sense of adventure. Millions of men would gladly have traded places with him now. He was going not only where no one had ever been before, but also where no one would ever go again. In all of history, he would be the only human being to visit the southern regions of Rama. Whenever he felt fear brushing against his mind, he could remember that. He had now grown accustomed to sitting in mid-air with the world wrapped around him. Because he had dropped 2 kilometers below the central axis, he had acquired a definite sense of up and down. The ground was only 6 kilometers below, but the arch of the sky was 10 kilometers overhead. The city of London was hanging up there near the zenith. New York, on the other hand, was the right way up, directly ahead.
Dragonfly, said Hub Control, you're getting a little low, 2,200 meters from the axis.
Thanks, he replied. I'll gain altitude. Let me know when I'm back at 20.
This was something he'd have to watch. There was a natural tendency to lose height, and he had no instruments to tell him exactly where he was. If he got too far away from the zero gravity of the axis, he might never be able to climb back to it. Fortunately, there was a wide margin for error, and there was always someone watching his progress through a telescope at the hub. He was now well out over the sea, pedaling along at a steady 20 kilometers an hour. In 5 minutes, he would be over New York. Already, the island looked rather like a ship, sailing forever round and round the cylindrical sea. When he reached New York, he flew a circle over it, stopping several times so that his little TV camera could send back steady, vibration-free images. The panorama of buildings, towers, industrial plants, power stations, or whatever they were, was fascinating, but essentially meaningless. No matter how long he stared at its complexity, he was unlikely to learn anything. The camera would record far more details than he could possibly assimilate, and one day, perhaps years hence, some student might find in them the key to Rama's secrets. After leaving New York, he crossed the other half of the sea in only 15 minutes. Though he was not aware of it, he had been flying fast over water, but as soon as he reached the south coast, he unconsciously relaxed, and his speed dropped by several kilometers an hour. He might be in wholly alien territory,
but at least he was over land. As soon as he had crossed the great cliff that formed the sea's southern limit, he panned the TV camera completely around the circle of the world.
Beautiful, said Hub Control. This will keep the mapmakers happy. How are you feeling?
I'm fine. Just a little fatigue, but no more than I expected. How far do you make me from the pole?
15.6 kilometers.
Tell me when I'm at 10. I'll take a rest then. And make sure I don't get low again. I'll start climbing when I've 5 to go.
20 minutes later, the world was closing in upon him. He had come to the end of the cylindrical section and was entering the southern dome. He had studied it for hours through the telescopes at the other end of Rama and had learned its geography by heart. Even so, that had not fully prepared him for the spectacle all around him. In almost every way, the southern and northern ends of Rama differed completely. Here was no triad of stairways, no series of narrow, concentric plateaus, no sweeping curve from hub to plain. Instead, there was an immense central spike, more than 5 kilometers long, extending along the axis. 6 smaller ones, half the size, were equally spaced around it. The whole assembly looked like a group of remarkably symmetrical stalactites hanging from the roof of a cave, or, inverting the point of view, the spires of some Cambodian temple set at the bottom of a crater. Linking these slender, tapering towers, and curving down from them to merge eventually in the cylindrical plain, were flying buttresses that looked massive enough to bear the weight of a world. And this, perhaps, was their function, if they were indeed the elements of some exotic drive units, as had been suggested. Jimmy approached the central spike cautiously, stopped pedaling while he was still 100 meters away, and let Dragonfly drift to rest. He checked the radiation level and found only Rama's very low background. There might be forces at work here that no human instruments could detect, but that was another unavoidable risk.
What can you see?
Hub Control asked anxiously.
Just Bighorn. It's absolutely smooth, no markings, and the point's so sharp you could use it as a needle. I'm almost scared to go near it. He was only half joking. It seemed incredible that so massive an object should taper to such a geometrically perfect point. Jimmy had seen collections of insects impaled upon pins, and he had no desire for his own dragonfly to meet a similar fate. He pedaled slowly forward until the spike had flared out to several meters in diameter, and stopped again. Opening a small container, he rather gingerly extracted a sphere about as big as a baseball, and tossed it toward the spike. As it drifted away, it played out a barely visible thread. The sticky bomb hit the smoothly curving surface and did not rebound. Jimmy gave the thread an experimental twitch, then a harder tug. Like a fisherman hauling in his catch, he slowly wound Dragonfly across to the tip of the appropriately christened Bighorn until he was able to put out his hand and make contact with it. I suppose you could call this some kind of touchdown, he reported to Hub Control. It feels like glass, almost frictionless and slightly warm. The sticky bomb worked fine. Now I'm trying the mic. Let's see if the suction pad holds as well. Plugging in the leads. Anything coming through?
There was a long pause. Then Hub Control said disgustedly,
Not a damn thing, except the usual thermal noises. Will you tap it with a piece of metal? Then at least we'll find if it's hollow.
Okay. Now what?
We'd like you to fly along the spike, making a complete scan every 0.5 kilometer,
and looking out for anything unusual. Then, if you're sure it's safe, you might go across to one of the little horns, but only if you're certain you can get back to zero G without any problems. 3 kilometers from the axis? That's slightly above lunar gravity. Dragonfly was designed for that. I'll just have to work harder. Jimmy, this is the captain. I've got second thoughts on that. Judging by your pictures, the smaller spikes are just the same as the big one. Get the best coverage of them you can with the zoom lens. I don't want you leaving the low gravity region, unless you see something that looks very important. Then, we'll talk it over.
Okay, Skipper, said Jimmy, and perhaps there was just a trace of relief in his voice. I'll stay close to Bighorn. Here we go again. He felt he was dropping straight downward into a narrow valley between a group of incredibly tall and slender mountains. Bighorn now towered a kilometer above him, and the 6 spikes of the Little Horns were looming up all around. The complex of buttresses and flying arches that surrounded the lower slopes was approaching rapidly. He wondered if he could make a safe landing somewhere down there in that cyclopean architecture. He could no longer land on Bighorn itself, for the gravity on its widening slopes was now too powerful to be counteracted by the feeble force of the sticky bomb. As he came ever closer to the South Pole, he began to feel more and more like a sparrow flying beneath the vaulted roof of some great cathedral, though no cathedral ever built had been even 1/100th the size of this place. He wondered if it was indeed a religious shrine, or something remotely analogous, but quickly dismissed the idea. Nowhere in Rama had there been any trace of artistic expression. Everything was purely functional. Perhaps the Ramans felt that they already knew the ultimate secrets of the universe and were no longer haunted by the yearnings and aspirations that drove mankind. That was a chilling thought, quite alien to Jimmy's usually not very profound philosophy. He felt an urgent need to resume human contact and reported his situation back to his distant friends.
Say again, Dragonfly, replied Hub Control. We can't understand you. Your transmission is garbled.
I repeat, I'm near the base of Little Horn Number 6 and am using the sticky bomb to haul myself in.
Understand only partially. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfectly. Repeat, perfectly.
Please start counting numbers.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Got part of that. Give us beacon for 15 seconds, then go back to voice.
Here it is.
Jimmy switched on the low-powered beacon that would locate him anywhere inside Rama, and counted off the seconds. When he went over to voice again, he asked plaintively,
What's happening? Can you hear me now?
Presumably Hub Control didn't, because the controller then asked for 15 seconds of TV. Not until Jimmy had repeated the question twice did the message get through.
Glad you can hear us okay, Jimmy, but there's something very peculiar happening at your end. Listen.
Over the radio, he heard the familiar whistle of his own beacon played back to him. For a moment, it was perfectly normal. Then a weird distortion crept into it. The 1,000-cycle whistle became modulated by a deep, throbbing pulse so low that it was almost beneath the threshold of hearing. It was a kind of basso profundo flutter in which each individual vibration could be heard, and the modulation was itself modulated. It rose and fell, with a period of about 5 seconds. Never for a moment did it occur to Jimmy that there was something wrong with his radio transmitter. This was from outside, though what it was and what it meant was beyond his imagination. Hub Control was not much wiser,
but at least it had a theory.
We think you must be in some kind of very intense field, probably magnetic, with a frequency of about 10 cycles. It may be strong enough to be dangerous. Suggest you get out right away. It may be only local. Switch on your beacon again, and we'll play it back to you. Then you can tell when you're getting clear of the interference.
Jimmy hastily jerked the sticky bomb loose and abandoned his attempt to land. He swung Dragonfly around in a wide circle, listening as he did so to the sound that wavered in his earphones. After flying only a few meters, he could tell that its intensity was falling rapidly. As Hub Control had guessed, it was extremely localized. He paused at the last spot where he could hear it, like a faint throbbing deep in his brain. So might a primitive savage have listened in awe-struck ignorance to the low humming of a giant power transformer, and even the savage might have guessed that the sound he heard was merely the stray leakage from colossal energies, fully controlled, but biding their time. Whatever this sound meant, Jimmy was glad to be clear of it. This was no place, among the overwhelming architecture of the South Pole, for a lone man to listen to the voice of Rama. 27. Electric Wind. As Jimmy turned homeward, the northern end of Rama seemed incredibly far away. Even the three giant stairways were barely visible, as a faint Y etched on the dome that closed the world. The band of the cylindrical sea was a wide and menacing barrier, waiting to swallow him, like Icarus, if his fragile wings should fail. But he had come all this way with no problems, and though he was feeling slightly tired, he now felt that he had nothing to worry about. He had not even touched his food or water, and had been too excited to rest. On the return journey, he would relax and take it easy. He was also cheered by the thought that the homeward trip could be 20 kilometers shorter than the outward one, for as long as he cleared the sea, he could make an emergency landing anywhere in the northern hemisphere. That would be a nuisance, because he would have a long walk, and much worse, would have to abandon Dragonfly, but it gave him a comforting safety margin. He was now gaining altitude, climbing back toward the central spike. Big Horn's tapering needle still stretched for a kilometer ahead of him, and sometimes he felt it was the axis on which this whole world turned. He had almost reached the tip of Big Horn when he became aware of a curious sensation. A feeling of foreboding, and, indeed, of physical as well as psychological discomfort, had come over him. He suddenly recalled, and this did nothing at all to help, a phrase he had once come across. Someone is walking over your grave. At first, he shrugged it off, and continued his steady pedaling. He certainly had no intention of reporting anything as tenuous as a vague malaise to Hub Control. But as it grew steadily worse, he was tempted to do so. It could not possibly be psychological. If it was, his mind was much more powerful than he realized. And he could, quite literally, feel his skin beginning to crawl. Now, seriously alarmed, he stopped in mid-air to consider the situation. What made it all the more peculiar was the fact that this depressed, heavy feeling was not completely novel. He had known it before, but could not remember where. He looked around him. Nothing had changed. The great spike of Big Horn was a few hundred meters above, with the other side of Rama spanning the sky beyond that. 8 kilometers below lay the complicated patchwork of the southern continent, full of wonders that no other man would ever see. In all the utterly alien,
yet now familiar landscape, he could find no cause for his discomfort. Something was tickling the back of his hand. For a moment he thought an insect had landed there, and brushed it away without looking. He had only half completed the swift motion when he realized what he was doing, and checked himself, feeling slightly foolish. Of course, no one had ever seen an insect in Rama. He lifted his hand and stared at it, mildly puzzled, because the tickling sensation was still there. It was then that he noticed that every individual hair was standing straight upright. All the way up his forearm it was the same, and so it was with his head when he checked with an exploring hand. So that was the trouble. He was in a tremendously powerful electric field. The oppressed, heavy sensation he had felt was that which sometimes precedes a thunderstorm on Earth. The sudden realization of his predicament brought Jimmy near to panic. Never before in his life had he been in real physical danger. Like all spacemen, he had known moments of frustration with bulky equipment, and times when, because of mistakes or inexperience, he had wrongly believed he was in a perilous situation. But none of these episodes had lasted more than a few minutes, and usually he was able to laugh at them almost at once. This time, there was no quick way out. He felt naked and alone in a suddenly hostile sky, surrounded by titanic forces that might discharge their furies at any moment. Dragonfly, already fragile enough, now seemed more insubstantial than the finest gossamer. The first detonation of the gathering storm would blast her to fragments. "Hub control," he said urgently. "There's a static charge building up around me. I think there's going to be a thunderstorm at any moment." He had barely finished speaking when there was a flicker of light behind him. By the time he had counted 10, the first crackling rumble arrived. 3 kilometers. That put it back around the little horns. He looked toward them and saw that every one of the 6 needles seemed to be on fire. Brush discharges, hundreds of meters long, were dancing from their points, as if they were giant lightning conductors. What was happening back there could take place on an even larger scale near the tapering spike of Bighorn. His best move would be to get as far as possible from this dangerous structure and to seek clear air. He started to pedal again, accelerating as swiftly as he could without putting too great a strain on Dragonfly. At the same time, he began to lose altitude. Even though this would mean entering the region of higher gravity, he was now prepared to take such a risk. 8 kilometers was much too far from the ground for his peace of mind. The ominous black spike of Bighorn was still free of visible discharges, but he did not doubt that tremendous potentials were building up there. From time to time the thunder reverberated behind him, rolling round and round the circumference of the world. It suddenly occurred to Jimmy that it was strange to have such a storm in a perfectly clear sky. Then he realized that this was not a meteorological phenomenon at all. In fact, it might be only a trivial leakage of energy from some hidden source deep in the southern cap of Rama. But why now? And, even more important, what next? He was well past the tip of Bighorn and hoped that he would soon be beyond the range of any lightning discharges. But now he had another problem. The air was becoming turbulent, and he had difficulty controlling Dragonfly. A wind seemed to have sprung up from nowhere, and if conditions became much worse, the Skybike's fragile skeleton would be endangered. He pedaled grimly on, trying to smooth out the buffeting by variations in power and movements of his body.
Because Dragonfly was almost an extension of himself, he was partly successful. But he did not like the faint creaks of protest that came from the main spar, or the way in which the wings twisted with every gust. And there was something else that worried him. A faint, rushing sound, steadily growing in strength, that seemed to come from the direction of Bighorn. It sounded like gas escaping from a valve under great pressure, and he wondered if it had anything to do with the turbulence he was battling. Whatever its cause, it gave him yet further grounds for disquiet. From time to time, he reported these phenomena, rather briefly and breathlessly, to Hub Control. No one there could give him any advice, or even suggest what might be happening. But it was reassuring to hear the voices of his friends, even though he was now beginning to fear that he would never see them again. The turbulence was still increasing. It felt almost as if he was entering a jet stream, which he had once done, in search of a record, while flying a high-altitude glider on Earth. But what could possibly create a jet stream inside Rama? He had asked himself the right question. As soon as he had formulated it, he knew the answer. The sound he had heard was the electric wind carrying away the tremendous ionization that must be building up around Bighorn. Charged air was spraying out along the axis of Rama, and more air was flowing into the low-pressure region behind. He looked back at that gigantic and now doubly threatening needle, trying to visualize the boundaries of the gale that was blowing from it. Perhaps the best tactic would be to fly by ear, getting as far as possible away from the ominous hissing. Rama spared him the necessity of choice. A sheet of flame burst out behind him, filling the sky. He had time to see it split into six ribbons of fire, stretching from the tip of Bighorn to each of the little horns. Then, the concussion reached him.